This is a production of the From the Periphery Media Collective. To support this podcast as well as all other projects, you can head out to patreon.com/from the periphery. Thank you for listening.
Hello, welcome to Syria, the Inconvenient Revolution. I'm your host, Leila Shami. And today I have with me two friends who were based in Sweden, who we actually interviewed in May. It's Cedric and Khuzama. In May, we introduced Cedric as Jan because being in Syria, there were some security considerations, so we used a pseudonym. But very happy to have you both here with us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Leila.
Thanks a lot.
Happy to be here also.
Yeah, we are happy to be here.
Yeah, it's good to see you because I know you've been through a very harrowing time and that you were in Sweden during the unrest in July. So maybe let's just start with a bit of an overview of what happened.
Yeah, I think you go because you can speak more methodologically about the events. Like you are better than me than in this.
Okay.
As you remember, maybe from our previous interview, in end of April, beginning of May from this year, there were first wave of attacks from the governmental forces against the Druze community, which they succeeded in dismantling and disarming the Druze factions that were out of Sweida and some neighborhoods next to Damascus. And regarding Sweida at this moment, there were attacks on Sweida, there were pressure put on Sweida, and there were first siege also on the region. And after this, they implemented a checkpoint on the main road between Sweida and Damascus at a junction between three roads, between Sweida and Damascus, but also Dera. And this checkpoint was manned by some tribal groups from Bedouins of the region of Al-Lajat, which is a desert region that is just above Sweida. And this tribal faction is related to a tribe that is involved since years in attacking the road and criminal activities on the road between Sweida and Damascus. They were always kidnapping people, attacking the cars and making carjacking and all this. And also they were, part of them, they were involved in war crimes with ISIS before. They are known for that. So we passed several times between May and July. We passed several times this checkpoint and we saw the fighters there. They were not wearing the uniform of the general security mainly. They had masks and I saw some of them wearing the ISIS patch on their clothes. So we had no problem with them. They were just checking the cars. I think they had this task. But we knew that there were many complaints by the people from Sweida because when they were passing the checkpoints, they were searched, they were humiliated sometimes, they were threatened, then there were kidnappings also. And in July, this escalated with the kidnapping of one trader by a tribal group related to these fighters. They kidnapped Fadlala Dwara, who was a trader from a small village in Sweida. And instead of asking for ransom, they stole everything from him, the truck, the goods and the money and the phone. And they throw him, after they tortured him, they throw him on the road. So the local factions, Druze factions, they would react, they would retaliate, and they kidnapped random Bedouins from Sweida and from outside Sweida, but who were not related to the gang who kidnapped Dwara. In response, the Bedouins from Sweida, they blocked the road and they kidnapped Druze civilians. So you had some hostages from both sides. And immediately after the Bedouins, they kidnapped Druze civilians, some factions from Sweida, they begin to have armed confrontation with the Bedouins. Also because the Bedouins, they used this event to attack Druze civilians inside the neighborhoods of Makwas. And they put some snipers on the roofs and they sniped also some people. So there were civilians who were killed during these fightings and because of snipers. And they began to arrive in the hospital on 14th of July. And so the Druze factions, they surrounded these Bedouin neighborhoods. And this escalated very fast with heavy shelling and mortars And at this stage, we had very fast in the first day of confrontation, we had like 7 people killed from the civilian community and 30 injured. And at this point, we contacted the spokesperson of the Southern Tribes Gathering, which is one of the main Bedouin factions that is involved in this incident. And it's the main tribal gathering in this region. And they told us that they were surrounded and besieged, that they had like something like 12 or 15 people injured that they could not send to the hospital. And they were saying that if we cannot send them to the hospital, they may die. So they asked for help from outside Sueda and mainly to the government and to the Red Crescent. And this was the reason given by the government to intervene in the region in the next day, in the next hours. They began to intervene in the evening of 14th. But they intervened with a lot of tribal groups from outside and mainly from this region, Al-Lajat. It's the same tribes who were manning the checkpoints. They were entering in Sueda and attacking villages in the northwest and the north of the region, of the province. And it was a very organized operation and intervention that was led by the governmental forces. So the general security related to the Ministry of Interior, the army related to the Ministry of Defense, and many tribal, informal tribal groups were related to the governmental forces. They were recruited, many of them, there were hundreds of them, they were recruited in the past month, and they had the card, ID card of the general security of the or the Ministry of Defense. So they were members of the governmental forces. And they entered in Sueda with them. From the 14th in the evening, and the biggest operation began on 15th. So they entered Sueda, and they very fast they shelled the villages. They shelled also the city of Sueda, and they came very close from the main city. They occupied more than 30 villages very fast, and immediately after they entered these villages, they began to loot the houses, to destroy them, to burn them down, and to kill people. So, and we knew this already because we saw they were filming their own crimes, and they were broadcasting their own crimes, and they were showing how they are humiliating the Druze, they were shaving their mustache, and they were killing them in front of the camera, mainly asking them, like insulting them, saying them that they are dogs and pigs, and asking them if they are Druze, and humiliating them, and before they executed them. Many old people were executed on these videos, and we saw it after also, that many of the casualties, they are old people that had not the time to flee or the possibility to flee. And because they were, from this moment, you had hundreds and thousands of people who were evacuating and fleeing this area, and they were going south to our village and village cities more in the south of the province. And yeah, the governmental forces, they arrived very fast next to Sueda city. And at this moment, they were beginning to be targeted by the Israeli airplanes who pretend to save the Druze, which is in their interest, but it's not in the interest of the Druze, actually. For many reasons, I will not explain here. We can develop this at, later, but... At some moment, they put such a huge pressure on the Druze factions that the Druze leadership agreed to make a meeting and to agree for a ceasefire. So they were a kind of ceasefire, agreeing for the general security forces to enter Sueda, but for the Ministry of Defense forces to retrieve from Sueda and to evacuate the groups who were committing crimes. But in fact, there were no difference between them. So they used this confusion to enter Sueda, and immediately after they entered Sueda, they began the massacre. And because they were going from house to house, they were fighting on the main road, because the Druze factions very fast, when they saw that the massacres are going on, they counterattacked, and Sueda city became a battleground, a huge battleground for more than 72 hours, basically from the first day, 14th of July, and 15th of July until 21st of July. They were fighting in Sueda city and the whole region, in the north and the west of the region. And next to these fightings, there were a lot of killing and looting and destruction. It's thousands of houses. And for example, in one of the main city where they entered first, called Al Mazra, you have more than 3,000 houses who were destroyed. So it's huge. And there were a lot of shelling from the both sides. They were using drones and rockets and mortars. And until the Druze factions, they succeeded to repel the offensive. And they liberated somehow Sweda city and their surroundings of Sweda city were liberated around 20 of July. But meanwhile, the general security forces and the army, they retreat first in the frame of an agreement, and then they came back and they occupied more than 30 villages that are still occupied today. And since then, since the official ceasefire, basically you have the governmental forces who are occupying all these cities and besieging the whole region, preventing anyone from leaving and from entering the region, including journalists. In the frame of this ceasefire, they bring in some humanitarian aid convoys, but they should not be necessary. If they would open the roads and bring back security and peace, the people, they would just begin trade again and there would not be a need for humanitarian aid. So it's really how the aid is weaponized to keep the siege going on and to put the pressure on the factions so they dismantle and they surrender, which is not happening because mainly the population, after the slaughter of 2,000 civilians from the community, Christians and Druze, no one in Sweda want to accept anymore to be related to the Syrian state, and the people, they don't want to be part of the social fabric there anymore. So the siege is going on, and we don't know the outcome of the siege, but what we know is that from this more than 30 villages and other areas that were directly impacted by the destruction, the lootings, you have around 190,000 civilians who are displaced. And you have also like almost 2,000 Bedouin civilians who were evacuated by the government. And it was told that they were kicked out by the Druze factions, but in fact it's a negotiation between the government and the Druze factions to evacuate the Bedouins so they are not impacted by the siege imposed to the rest of the region. So they evacuated a lot of Bedouins, and they were communicating a lot around this, like justifying somehow the situation by pretending that the Bedouins, they were ethnically cleansed by the Druze faction, which is not what happened. So yes, we were on 20th of July in this period. We entered Sweda after the massacres, and we could document all this. So we gathered many proofs of what happened, of the massacres. We saw people burnt alive and killed, and this is what happened during several days in Sweda. Because during all this period, while the governmental forces, they were pretending that they were retrieving, leaving the region and then coming back, actually the tribal groups, the tribal factions from the Bedouins, they never left, and they continued to attack even after the ceasefire agreements many times. I think more than 15 times they violated the ceasefire agreement. And actually, this is the situation today. There's still sometimes attacks on villages, and governmental forces, they are just occupying one third of the region. And basically.
Thank you. That's a very comprehensive overview. And I mean, you touched on many points. One was the disinformation and how the events in Sweda were portrayed both by the transitional government and by the media, and the Syrian Network for Human Rights, which I think is the most reliable source for these facts. You know, it recorded deaths on both sides and of Druze and the general security forces. But from civilian deaths, it's very clear from their figures that the vast majority of people that were killed were Druze civilians and a very few number of Bedouin civilians. Can you tell us a little bit about the humanitarian situation in Sweden now? Because the road was cut, there was a siege on Sweden, there was a lack of water, food, medical supplies going in. What's the situation there today?
So yeah, I can speak about this. So yeah, as Sedake was saying, just to say that we did not really escape. You said escape, but we did. We because we really wanted to stay there. Even just we had to come back because there are things that are. I mean, we were already planning to come back, and we had to come for other reasons, but. I mean, since also like the family is still there, my family is still there, so it was first very it was very hard, the whole situation, even to decide to leave. I mean, even though it was already planned to leave, it was the finishing, the ending of our staying there, but it was in the middle of all what happened, so it was extremely hard. It was like, yeah, after all the stage of siege, of lack of electricity, lack of internet, lack of water. I mean, and lacking, I mean, there's not. I mean, the water, it was just people, they were just using what they have already. But we were in total blackout. I mean, we were lucky because we have some relative who had like just some solar panels, who have electricity. They have they had internet, so they have like the Starlink. So, but other than this, we would be in the total blackout, like the whole region. This is why the people also they were discovering later what was happening really. So the situation was starting to be bad since then. I mean, since the first days, since they started, since there was no electricity anymore for 5 days, it was already so bad. I mean, now there's the situation is still since like 55 days, 56 days, it's under siege. There are humanitarian convoys that are entering, but of course the help they are saying the transitional government they are saying they are helping, but actually it's not they are helping. It's international aid coming from abroad or people donating from abroad sending help, but it's not the government that they are sending help. They are just organizing the entry, and sometimes even they cannot protect this entry because we saw that many humanitarian workers they were kidnapped. We saw that people they were shot at, like they were just leaving normally by their car after they got the access with the approval with the like the civil defense and the general security, and they were shot at anyway. So even this road, they are unable to control it. And the electricity is still until now, it's very, very few. I mean, you have electricity like, I don't know, maybe the whole 24 hours, you have 2 to 3 hours. And if it's coming, and it's cutting the whole time because there is all the time someone is coming to these towers of electricity and they are cutting them from the base. And this cutting is happening in the regions where they're outside of the control of the people of Sweden. So they are or in Dara or they are more to the north. So it's all like attacks. So the people there, they stay in this situation. So and many officials also they went on the TV from the government to say there's no siege. I mean, like they are just saying it very normally that there's no siege. But what if there's no siege, why you are organizing humanitarian convoys? I mean, why the people they are not coming and going back? I mean, it's the whole situation is actually it's very shocking. It's until now it's very shocking. It's like unbelievable what happened, what is still happening. The reaction of the Syrian communities, the Syrian people on the social media, it's shocking. The reaction of people I know, friends I know, that they did not try even to reach me, it's also shocking. The way that the people were killed, it's shocking. I mean, the numbers, we are not sure until now because these 30 villages, we don't know how many people they are still there. Even in some villages, Wemra, when the Red Crescent they entered, the bodies, there were nothing left even. I mean, there's just it was too late. I mean, you barely can even know the people. It's just sometimes from the clothes, you know, from because they are under their houses or something. And And Sadak, you mentioned the number, like more than 120,000 people from the villages. They all left, I mean, to the other villages of Sweden. And this city, it's already, the situation is bad there. I mean, the drought, it's hitting it very badly. There's no really water, so there's no really food security there. So this mass of people that they came to these villages that they are already poor, it's creating a huge pressure. Now many of these people, they are in the schools, and now the schools will come to, like, now soon. They should start like in 10 days, and there's still no any answer for this. The baccalaureate, you know, like students of this like the high school where they should finish, they could not make their exams, and there's no, also they don't know what they are. They lost their year. Many students also they lost they lost their studies. I mean, or they are graduating, or they lost a year just like this, because they cannot go to Damascus, even though sometimes you find some buses are they manage to arrive safe, because they can make an agreement. They say that we are coming this day, but many people, they don't dare to go there. I mean, especially the students. I mean, the families, they will not send their kids into these schools to make their exams. And yeah, so the situation is, even for the humanitarian aid, I mean, sometimes the road can stop, can be blocked, you know, like just blocked. It's no one can go, no one can enter. For example, for the last I mean, yesterday there was a bus that was coming entering to Sweda from Damascus, from the Damascus Sweda road, and that was the first time that a bus that came from Damascus that arrived to Sweda. But this bus is still not used normally. It's only for like two times humanitarian aids came from this road. And I also read and heard from many sources that these convoys, these humanitarian aids, they are also harassed on the road. They have to pay money for the checkpoints. They are not just like coming easily and delivering the humanitarian aids that they have. So there are many this small details that it's also hard to know all the information regarding them. So there are also still things that we are still learning every day that are coming to our knowledge. And yeah.
I mean, I
Yeah.
think, like you, one of the things that I found very shocking was the response on social media from Syrians, pro-revolutionary Syrians. And just to give a perspective from someone on the outside, it was very difficult on the outside to have an understanding of what was happening in the on the ground in July. But there were many videos emerging. Like there was one example, a Druze guy was stopped by security forces, and they asked him, "Are you Sunni or Druze?" And he said, "I'm Syrian." And they said, "Again, are you Sunni or Druze?" And he said, "I'm Druze," and they killed him. So a clear sectarian killing of a civilian. There were also those many videos of people forcibly having their mustaches shaved, these kind of humiliation that, regardless of whether you can understand what's happening between the different factions and the politics of it all, those were such clear violations that should have been condemned, but instead many people tried to justify what was happening and really took the narrative of the transitional government. Now, I think though, an
No,
area where many Syrians obviously felt outraged was the intervention of Israel. There was the attack on the 16th of July in Damascus, in addition to the airstrikes that you spoke about. And of course, Hejri was asking for support from Israel. Now, I know when we spoke last time, this was a very unpopular position within the Druze community, and many of the Druze opposed Israel. We saw protests happening in Sweda against Israeli intervention. But obviously, that's changed now since the massacres, and we saw very sad to see the protest in Sweda that was many people were holding Israeli flags. Can you give us a bit of an indication, like how this has impacted into Druze politics? Because when we spoke last time, though, it was clear that Al-Hajri had limited support within the Druze community, but it appears that since these violations in July, that support for Hajri has increased, and more people within the community are looking to Israel to help protect them.
You want to go ahead?
I think I want just to say that first, yeah, what you spoke about, all the reaction on social media, that is really, it's really very shocking. It's very unbelievable. Even you see, I mean, even in protests that happened here and in Europe, or protests that happened in Hama and other places, where the people, they were clearly singing, saying that we want to eliminate all the minorities, against the Druze, against the Alawi. They were even like, they were holding scissors in a protest in Hama when they were waiting for Jolani to come for a visit. I mean, and this scissor, we saw it even with one of the bodies of the fighters who were in Sweida. He
Bedouin
was holding
fighters.
it. I mean, they brought these with them. So you know that these people, they were coming for personal kill, for personal revenge, for personal humiliation. So I think from all this, I mean, all this rage and craziness and all this like barbarity that we saw from the reactions of the people, from the reaction of the media, from the reaction of the friends, from the reaction of what the people who call themselves revolutionary, or they call themselves human rights activists, even the people who are now like going for, they are voicing themselves to struggle for liberty in Syria, for the cause of the displaced and disappeared, forcibly disappeared people in Syria. Everyone has disappeared. Everyone, all the activists, we hear no one actually. It's very sad. It's very shocking. It's revealing. I mean, many, many truths about how the people, they are unclear inside their heads. How, if you want to struggle for a cause, you don't separate the causes. And I think this is from the main reason why it shifted the opinion of the people on Sweden. Not because they are now supporting Hajri, I think, and many, they don't care about Hajri, they don't follow him. It's just they are in total anger. They are depressive. They are just disappointed. They are usually disappointed by their fellow Syrians, by their from all this reaction that happened, and so they are enraged. And I think this is why the people, they are saying, when this man, he said that he asked him who you are, and he said, I am Syrian, and he was shot. And many people, they said, Syria has shut down. It fell down at this moment. It has gone for with no coming back. When these three guys, they were thrown out from the window, from the terrace, from the fourth floor, and they were shot the same moment. I mean, there is something that is meaningless now for the people. It's meaningless to say, let's go back to live as Syrians all together. Let's be unified. There's no meaning for unity anymore. To be unified with who? With the people who are holding scissors and hammer, calling for us to be killed. For what? With whom? So I think even the people who raise the Israeli flags in the protests, which are not a lot, and even if, I mean, they can be mostly their guys, they are young people. They are provoking. They are mostly provoking. They are mostly doing this as a reaction. Even if, because, I mean, the people, if you see the intellectuals, the people who are in the Karami Square, who participated in the revolution from 2011 and even from before, these people, they don't care about Al-Hajri. They know that Israel has nothing to do in Syria and for the Druze. But even these people who are even from after the fall of the regime, they were saying we should go with the Syrians, we should at least give a chance for this government. These people themselves, now they are saying we should maybe forget about this and we should be independent. So, I mean, it's really what happened. It did not only create like some, it broke the thing. I mean, it's shattered. somehow the whole belonging and the idea of identity to be belonging to Assyria, and even the people, they started to see what does it mean to be Assyrian, if
I mean,
like if
what we're seeing, I think, is the impact of the decades that we've had of sectarianization by the Assad regime playing out. And now we're seeing very much this Muslimia Sunniya, this idea of a Sunni victimhood narrative. And it's very true. Under the Assad regime, the Sunni community suffered the most out of all of the communities in Syria. But then the way that that's being reversed is, okay, then as Sunnis with a demographic majority, we should organize the state according to our interests. But this path will never bring peace. All there is taking that route is more civil conflict. Syria's a diverse country. You have Sunnis, Alawis, Druze, Ismailis. You know, the only way to build a safe, secure, and democratic future is to ensure that all of Syria's diverse groups are able to participate into the political process. And what happened in the coast in March, and what's happened in Sweida in July and continuing until today, is just putting Syria backwards. It's taking Syria off the path of being able to build a country in which people feel like Syrians, which every community can feel that they have an equal stake, equal participation, and work together to build a future.
Yeah,
Yeah, exactly. If you want to say something.
I just wanted, because I think it's very important, this point where Assad, what happened under Assad. I mean, one of the first thing we did when we arrived in Syria, it was to meet the people in Daraya, in Yarmouk, in Tadamon, in all these places where a majority, Sunni majority, was persecuted, destroyed, killed, slaughtered by the Assad regime. I mean, we know this, and we wanted to document about this, and we will continue to do it. But it's much harder because of this sectarianism, because we have to focus now on the massacres in Sweida somehow. And Sweida was one part of our documentary movie project about the communities in Syria, and we went to see the last of the one of the last of the Jews, and we met the people in Maaloula, the Christians. But we met not only the minorities; we met also, I mean, the people in Tadamon, of course, many of them that we met, they are Turkmens, so they're also a minority, but they're a Sunni minority, like the Kurds. And the people in Yarmouk, the majority, they are Palestinians. They are a Sunni community, but they're a minority as Palestinians. So what do we speak about? You know, it's like it's even in the majority there are minorities. And what the people they don't say is that in Sweida, and we know one person from one of the five Muslim families of Sweida that were in the region before the Druze even came. And they are not Bedouins. They are five Muslim families. And you know what? I mean, they are trapped inside Sweida with the Druze, and they are friends with the Druze, and they live there, and they are in harmony there. So, and we don't speak also about the Christians that were destroyed, like the six churches were burned to the ground, and Christian families were slaughtered also. So it's also not only something about, you know, it's very complex, and there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation about what's happening, what's going on. And this new Bani Umayyah thing, oh, it's not based. This, for me, is a new generation, a very young generation. They didn't not go through the revolution. They did not take part in the process of the revolution. They were teenagers maybe, and they grew up. Their teenage life and their adult life was during the civil war. So they don't know nothing about the revolution. They don't know nothing about the values, the secular values of the revolution. They are just beginning everything from scratch, you know. And with the revenge feeling and the hate and the misinformation, ignorance that spreaded during the civil war, and all this also things, and there are this confusion, the confusion and things. But if we come back to Sweida, there's something that is very important to notice. I mean, Al-Hajri, he was loyal to the regime before 2023, and we have to say this. He was a Shabiha. Yes, it's true. He was a Shabiha. And I can say it because I'm French. And I can say it because I don't face the same consequences by saying this. And on the other hand, you have this Men of Dignity movement who were very involved in fighting back the tribal factions and the Syrian regime forces who attacked Ouidah in July. This Rijal Karami, who was the major, they were the majority in March, like they were representing the majority. They were not the majority. They were representing the feeling and the opinion of the majority. Why they are marginalized today? Why they are you have or you have these two gangster factions who are supporting the Jolani, or you have Hajari, and all of them they were somehow involved in some unclear political actions before. But the most clear faction that were representing the majority of the Druze, why we don't speak about them? Why the people, the Sunni revolutionaries outside of Ouidah, they are not speaking about Rijal Karami, who went to the TV the first day of the massacre. The spokesperson, Bassem Abu Fakhr, he went to the television the first day of the massacres and he said what? He opposed the Israeli intervention very clearly. So why he is not the hero? Why this faction, they are not the one that the government is showing? Because they are opposed to them. Because they want the one who are licking their ass, sorry to say this in the radio, but it's what's happening now. And you have all these things. You know that among the tribes, the Al Naim tribes, for example, who is one of the most involved, the Al-Qaeda tribe that is one of the most involved, but also the Marsoumi tribe, who is one of the most involved in the killing and the slaughter in Ouidah. All of them, they were involved in helping the Assad regime before. They were working the Assad regime, and part of them they were working with ISIS before. So no one of them they were with the HTS or Al-Nusra, or they were a very minority, and they changed the configuration of the alliances along the time. You know, so all these people who are like pretending that they are facing pro-Israel people. First of all, the Salafists, they never faced Israel. Why they don't go to Quneitra? Why they don't go to the Golan? Why they don't go to make jihad against Israel directly? If the Zionists, they are the problem, why they go to Ouidah to slaughter civilians? It's weird. All this is unlogical. It's unlogical, and I don't even understand how the propaganda is working so well to make people be so confused about who is the real target. It's because these people, they are just full of hate, and actually they wanted to go to Ouidah to bring women and fridges, many of them. And this is also something that is weird because they are poor people from the Eastern and they take a revenge by coming to the West, coming to the cities. They are somehow, they went to the houses and they bring furniture and they bring with them the woman. You have how much women? 200 to 300 women who were taken away from Ouidah
Kidnapped.
in this. Kidnapped. And even in front of the television, there were several cases where they were filmed with the women in their cars, and it's a shame. These people, they are a shame, you know. They are not at all representing any revolution, anything that has something to do with 2011. Even Shara, like Jolani, he was not involved in the revolution in 2011. He was too busy to build up Al-Nusra at this time.
I mean, there were some independent voices and Sunni activists that were speaking out against what's happened in Ouidah, but something else that was very concerning was the way in which those voices were silenced. So in July, when there were the attacks happening in Ouidah, my husband and a couple of friends of mine attended a protest in Damascus, which had a very simple messaging. It wasn't really taking a political side. All it said is Syrians spilling the blood of other Syrians is forbidden. So just calling for peace. And that was attacked, the demonstrators there. It was a peaceful sit-in and it was attacked by what is the new Shabiha,
Yeah,
stopping
exactly.
critical voices against the new government. And another example, there was a journalist, Noor Suleiman, who spoke out against what was happening in Ouidah, and she was briefly detained. So there are critical voices, but one of the concerns is that those voices are being silenced and that there isn't, that the democratic space is actually closing now.
Yeah, and also what I want to mention about the silencing of the voices, I have journalist friends, and among them there's this French journalist who was arrested by the Israeli when he came to Quneitra. you remember, it's several months ago. There were a French journalist photographer who went to Quneitra, and he was arrested by the Israeli. And he's not getting visa anymore. So after he left Syria, he wants to go back. He's not getting visa. And also what I want to say, many journalists, they could not enter Suwaida because when they arrived to the general security checkpoint, they were told by the general security themselves that the Druze, they don't want to let them enter. And this is what they say to the press, to their redaction, to the Western media. They say, oh, the Druze, they didn't want to let us enter. But it's not true. I mean, they were stopped by the general security. No one was preventing journalists from entering Suwaida. It's on the Druze side. I mean, it was the regime. So there's really something happening about the new regime, like implementing new regulation to and now they made this new regulation also to ask for their troops not to release videos from their actions anymore. So they want to hide the crimes. I have the feeling that I see what's happening in France with the police brutality, that they make laws so it's forbidden to film the police brutality. It's not forbidden for the police to commit police brutality, you know. It's what's happening. And on the other hand, also I finish on this also, there are these two guys who came back from Germany. There's one is journalist in Derzor. He was arrested, and after he was released, he was hanged in his house in Derzor. This is also something to say. And there's another one. He's not a journalist. He's not a free voice, but he was coming back from Germany, and he was arrested, allegedly because he was speaking loud or arguing with general security guards next to the Umayyad Mosque. So he was arrested, and he was found dead. And they accused him that he was hitting his head against the walls. Like, I feel it's the same narrative of the Western police when they kill someone. It's very, and this is happening again. So again, people are dying in the prison, the Syrian prisons, and in the hands of the general security. So it means nothing changed, actually. It's the status quo is the same somehow. Also, in the frame of the relation between the new regime and Israel, the same. Huh? They are negotiating exactly the same framework of agreements of non-aggression between Israel and the Syrian regime, as Assad before.
Yeah, and also I wanted to say something regarding the. I mean, also regarding that. Always now when we speak about. Israel, we link it to the Druze, and we don't speak about what you just mentioned, that how Al-Jawlani himself is just trying from the first day after the shoot of the after the fall of the regime to make agreements with Israel, with America. I mean, to make normalization, and he was saying it very clearly even. I mean. And several days ago, there were people who protested in front of the American embassy in Damascus to say that we refuse the normalization with Israel. But also, like, I mean, it's exactly opposing what Jolani himself is saying, that if this is what is the benefit of Syria, as he's saying, he will do it. So, I mean, there's also this very double standards, and the people, they are just... I mean, as we say, like, if you want to criticize these people because they were trapped in a moment where even, I mean, the people, they were just trapped in a place where they were just calling for help from anyone. And many times, in many situations in Syria, in Daraa, or in Idlib, during the revolution, the people, they were asking for international help. Israel helped members of the civil defense to get out from Daraa. Also, they were treated in their hospitals. So, I mean, when we speak about something, it's just looking on from one narrow perspective, and it's not understanding the context of what is happening and why these voices are coming out. And we saw these voices when we were in Suwaida, who are speaking about, you know, like Muwaffaq Tarif, the sheikh of the Druze community, who is in Palestine. And so, I mean, they were kids. They were just they did not really have this understanding even about, you know, exactly, they did not even know how to explain their why they are doing this, why they are supporting Israel. It was just for them, they were following somehow. And I think it's also the people there. What's happening is like the attack that happened on Sweden, that's just towards the without brain. And this is also what we see in social media now. It's just there is something, and this is why it's shocking, because the thing that's happening, it cannot enter to the head, you know, how
Because
the
ultimately
reality that's happening now.
ultimately it's an act of desperation, isn't it? You know, going through such a traumatic event as what happened in July, feeling totally abandoned. You know,
Exactly.
And I mean, the youth of Sweden, they are not different from the youth on the other side. I mean, these young guys were confused and saying bullshit about Israel and their Druze identity. Why would they be different from the Bani Umayyah on the other side, from the Sunni youth? They are thinking the same way in this very sectarian refuge that they are finding a refuge inside of religion. And so why are we surprised that they react the same in Sweden but on the other side? I mean, what we saw also, I remember in March, there were some faction who were putting an Israeli flag on one of the main roundabout, and in the same evening there were another faction tearing down this flag of Israel because there were no Israeli flag. There is no any Israeli flag in Sweden. Why? If the people there are so pro-Israel, there would be Israeli flags everywhere. There is no anyone, any of them. And in March, they were even struggling not to put them. And what happened after the massacre is very, very representative, because in all this period before the massacres, we even went to commemoration of Sultan Bashar al-Atrash, who is a hero of the Syrian revolution. He's the one who implemented the first time the independence flag, and he was kicking out the French, and he was against Israel very clearly. And there were commemoration for his for him during this month. And they put in Swaida, in the village of Akraya, which is his stronghold where he was living and where he's buried, they put all the flags of the Syrian independence with the three stars, just the flag of the revolution. And we saw exactly when the massacre happened, the youth of the village, they went there and they burned down these flags. They burned down these flags, and they did not really put the Rus flag instead. They just were enraged and were saying, okay, this revolution is not for us. We will stop believing in the fact that this flag is ours. And this young from the other side, from the tribes, this youth from the tribes, and we have some of them that were arrested, they were catched by the Druze faction actually, and they said that no one of them was born before 2009. Even they were all younger as from 2009. They were born after 2009. And they say this young on the other side, they destroyed the statue of Sultan Bashar al-Atrash. Among the things that they destroyed at Sweida, they were even removing the picture of Sultan Bashar, who is representing the best the Syrian revolution and the Syrian independence, and who was the first to hold the Syrian revolution flag. I mean, their flag is not the Syrian revolution flag, it's the flag of al-Nusra, the one with the Shahada. And this needs to be clearly said, and we are sad that on the Karama Square, the people, they should have, in reaction and provocation, they should all wave the Syrian revolution flag in country. So, you know, this would be a very strong political message to say. But yeah, it's as someone told me the last days, told me, yeah, it's an illusion, it's a utopia that the people, they react good when they are attacked.
Well, I really appreciate you coming and sharing your experience. I mean, it's been very difficult months for you, and I don't think there's a lot of hope at this current moment in time, but I hope we will continue this conversation in the future and have more positive things to report on. Is there anything you would like to say before we finish?
But thank you, Leila, for hosting us again to speak about also what's happening and to share this information, because it's very important also to, I mean, to spread also the point of view from the people on the ground, from the people who have still families there. So thank you for this. And yeah, I mean, we are hour by hour following what's happening there actually. And yeah. We will see what, I mean, I think changes are happening very fast. So yeah, it's for the positive outcomes.
Yeah, thank you very much for this.